The Tom Woods Show, episode 643.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, gang, I got an easy way for you to earn 50 smackers. You listening? Ebates has changed its reward policy. You refer two friends and you get 50 bucks. Ebates rewards you for shopping at a wide array of online retailers with cash rebates. And you get 50 smackers if you refer just two friends. Surely you have two friends, then you can have 50 smackers in your pocket. Check it out at tomwoods.com/ebates. Folks, if you enjoy this show, you're really going to like the free course I've made available to you on the real history of the U.S. presidents. Very, very helpful, especially during an election year. Check it out at freehistorycourse.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here, talking about the one kind of diversity colleges avoid. And I'm pretty sure you know what I'm talking about. You go to college campuses pretty much anywhere in the U.S., and what do you find? Everybody on the faculty holds more or less the same views. Yeah, there's some diversity that extends about 2 millimeters, but otherwise, it's more or less the same view. And in particular, when you compare the general consensus among the faculty that you will find, and you compare that to the range of opinions that actually does exist out there, including libertarianism, you'll see just how narrow it is. So I want to talk about this today, and joining me to do that is John Hasnas. Now, before I introduce John, let me point out that when I talked to him, for some reason, I had it in my head that this was episode 642. I did two episodes as 642, so this one is 643. So don't listen to me when I'm giving you tomwoods.com/642 as the show notes page. That's wrong. Pay no attention to that. It's tomwoods.com/643. I apologize for the error. Professor Hasnas, who has been on the show before, is an associate professor of business at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business and director of the Georgetown Institute for the Study of Markets and Ethics. John, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
I want to talk to you about an article you had in the Wall Street Journal very recently, and we have your initial version of it linked on the show notes page. This being episode 642, it's at tomwoods.com/642. And it's about the subject of faculty diversity, which has been a topic since I was in school back in the early 90s. And it seems to me like the nature of the discussion hasn't changed at all, and the way they go about defining and pursuing faculty diversity hasn't changed at all. What exactly is being left out, in your opinion, of discussions of a diverse faculty?
Okay, well, when we are pursuing diversity with regard to faculty hiring, we are always pursuing and increasing the numbers of either women or minority faculty. And by minority, I mean people from different races, different cultural backgrounds, different ethnic backgrounds. We are trying to, the university generally is trying to be more inclusive of people from a wide range of different genetic backgrounds. And that's what diversity means. It's to be inclusive in that respect. As far as I have experienced myself, there's no effort to reach out or include people from differing philosophical, ideological, or political backgrounds. So diversity doesn't usually include getting people with all ranges of opinion. It actually is restricted to getting people from various different cultural and ethnic backgrounds.
Now, this, of course, is the theme we're going to want to discuss, but I can't help asking, not that it disproves anything, individual cases, but you've been at Georgetown for 20 years. I mean, that's no small thing. When you applied there, did everybody know? Was it just screaming from your CV where you stood, or did you try to hide that, or did you just let the chips fall where they may? What was your own strategy?
That's probably a poor question for me, because I'm a professor in a business school, but that's not the job I was trying to get. I My degrees are in law and philosophy, and I went on the market to be a law professor or a philosophy professor. I'm a business professor because that's the position I was able to obtain. Trying to be a professor, that's a very difficult position to get. In a way, landing a position as a professor is a little bit like playing in a tournament. Very few people get to make it to the NBA. Very few people can make it as movie actors or stars. It's a very competitive field. It's very difficult to get a job. For all I know, I was not a high enough rated candidate to get a job in a position that I was seeking. I did get a job in a business school, and I was happy to be a professor, and I've been happy to be a professor since. But I can't tell you the degree to which my viewpoints worked against me. I suspect, of course, that it did to some extent, but when you're a candidate, you don't know.
Right, of course. Yeah, you can't. But do you have any advice for anybody going on the academic job market? I'll tell you one piece of advice I give, certainly, is you shouldn't be thinking, well, this is before you get onto the job market, but when you get into your PhD program, I sometimes will encounter students who they want to write the Austrian view of blah, 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 or they want to do the libertarian history of the U.S. And I say, you will have ample opportunity to do all those things once you have your job. But right now, you got to write your dissertation. Like, my dissertation has nothing whatsoever to do with libertarianism, not at all. Now, there are ways you can make that work, but I think you really your focus has to be make a contribution to your field. That's the primary focus. And then later, you can pursue all the things that catch your fancy. Let's start there. I mean, do you think I'm on the right track, at least with that?
Yes, I definitely do. If you're asking me what I tell people who want to become academics—
Yeah.
Prospective students, it's easy for me to say what my advice is. You should work on what you care about, what's meaningful to you. Your job is to make a contribution to whatever field you're going to enter in. What your job is to increase knowledge and seek the truth. And you should do that completely independently of any political view agenda that you have. If you want to be a professor, you're not— Well, in my opinion, if you want to be a professor, you're not trying out to be an activist. You're trying to add to knowledge. And you'll do your best work if you do the thing that you know best, that you care about, that you believe in. And, I never recommend to people to hide anything that they believe, but just to do their best work. What you want to do is you want to show that you will make a contribution to the academic dialogue in whatever field you're in, and that you'll be a good colleague, and that if you get a position, you'll be good in the classroom, add to do research that adds to knowledge, and be a good colleague. That's just general advice for anyone who wants to be a professor.
Right, because we should bear in mind that one factor that the search committee is going to keep in mind, whatever ideological issue may arise, they are going to ask themselves, will we be able to stand having this guy down the hall from us for the next 20 years?
Yeah, that's the most important thing. I mean, they want someone who will be a good colleague and help advance the mission more than anything else. So you do want to show that you're a good colleague. No one likes to have a raving polemicist around who's always causing disputes to arise that needn't arise.
Right. You don't have to, I once got a really good piece of advice from somebody at the Institute for Humane Studies, which is actually where I first saw you in the early 1990s. Not that you would remember that, but I certainly do. And they said, look, any place you might happen to be standing, any building you might happen to be standing in, there are 27 people uttering some kind of error or another. It's not your responsibility to go and correct all of these. You have to pick your battles and decide what's, frankly, socially appropriate to do, and it's not always appropriate to do that. Get things off your chest by writing a newspaper column, but not by ripping people's heads off at the water cooler. I want to talk about search committees, and I was surprised that you mentioned this in your column because I thought this is taking a little bit of a shot at your own institution, but we can all give stories like this. Back when I was in academia, I was on a search committee for, I guess it was the I don't know, some kind of head of student activities, some kind of thing like that. And we got a pretty good CV submitted to us from somebody in Texas who looked pretty qualified. But we were basically instructed not to consider this person because, you know, if they're from Texas, well, there could be some kind of, you know, cultural incompatibility, by which they meant Texas is a more conservative state. We're running the risk of accidentally hiring a conservative. Now, if they had said, well, we can't hire somebody from such and such state because there's a really high percentage of black people there and there's a chance this person could turn out to be black. Oh, of course, you know, everybody would be fired. We'd, you know, we'd be hearing about it forever. But this was just considered normal and nobody batted an eye.
Yeah, I think that that's not that unusual an experience. How can I put this? I've never met anybody who's an intentional bad actor, or I don't think there's anyone who is. First of all, I'll back up and I'll make an observation. When I read about these matters, I see people often accusing university administrations of pursuing an ideological agenda. I don't think that's the case. I've never seen any administration that's pushing some kind of ideological agenda. I'm at Georgetown. I think we have a great president. I think in the business school, we have a great dean. These people are doing a good job. Generally speaking, people who are in the administration of universities are conciliators. That's why they're in those positions. They're the people least likely to be strict ideological adherents. And, you know, maybe this will sound dismissive in a way it shouldn't, but you know, they're the people least likely to be committed to some kind of principle. Their job is to make the university run effectively, and they're usually conciliators. So it's not as though there's some conspiracy among university administrators to keep a certain viewpoint dominant in the academy. What's going on is something that's much more under the surface. I just think that most faculty assume that their position is correct, and they have when they're evaluating. In fact, I don't think any faculty necessarily is. Very few faculty are intentionally ideologically biased. Just when they make judgments of what's good work and what's meritorious work, it usually is going to be work that looks like theirs. The idea behind the diversity, the quest for diversity in universities, is something like this: if the academy is dominated by white males from a common type of background, they're likely to judge the work of people from different cultures and different backgrounds. They won't appreciate its merits. They won't judge it as highly. They'll see it as not good work. And as a result, the university will remain insular because the people making the decisions don't have a broad view. Right? That's why there's a quest for diversity that brings in people from different cultural backgrounds. In my opinion, something similar to that is what goes on. If most of the people who have the positions and are making judgments have a left, you know, liberal left or a particular political, philosophical, or ideological viewpoint, they're not out to be exclusionary, just that when they make judgments of merit, they tend to see work by conservatives or libertarians as not good work. I mean, that stuff is just clearly wrong. I mean, the way this comes across most often to me is the judgment that the work done by people who have a different ideological perspective is not good work, and that's why we don't hire. So the idea that we need some kind of impetus to increase ideological diversity is to somehow break this down. I don't know if in my...
Yeah, I understand that.
All of us have our own personal experiences, but I personally remember once being on the job market and we were discussing one of my articles, and one of the people on the hiring committee looked at me and said, "How can you take that position without being a libertarian crank?" I mean, the viewpoint being expressed was, if I'm advocating this, then I must be, you know, must be something wrong with me. And it's not that this person had anything against me. It's just that his view of what's correct and what's true and what's good work didn't include a libertarian viewpoint. That's the kind of thing that we tend to run into.
Now, I get that you're saying that it's not a malicious conspiracy where they sit down and say, all right, everybody, we're going to make a deliberate attempt to exclude libertarians or conservatives. It's more a question of they put high value on their own work, and they assume that all right-thinking people and people with solid training and background are going to come to the conclusions that they come to. I get that, but it still seems like there is something malicious beneath the surface, or at the very least blameworthy, in that obviously what we have to say has at least, you know, whether people agree with us or not, there are obviously some insights that we have that are at the very least worth considering, and that they're not even at a point where they can concede that suggests to me that they're not intellectually curious enough, and that is that's a demerit in my view.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with you. For me, it's a matter of how much of this is conscious and how much of it
right.
is not conscious. I'm sure that there are some bad actors in important positions in the academy. I'm sure that's the case. Personally, I haven't met anyone like that. The people I meet tend to be well-meaning professors doing their job, but they have blinders on. They just can't see broadly enough. So another personal anecdote that illustrates it is I sent out an article which was making what I thought was a good argument for an unconventional and controversial position. And I got a review back, and the reviewer obviously was a professor. He cared about what he was doing. He wrote the review carefully, but basically what he said was, this article appears to be attacking this position, but since that's not reasonable, I can't read the argument in that way. It was outside the bounds of his vision that somebody could be attacking a position that so many people on the left had adhered to. And he reviewed the article as though it was something other than what it was. There wasn't malice behind it. It's just that there's a limited viewpoint, and that comes from so many people being within a certain range of opinion, so that after a while it seems as though that's the entire scope of the range.
You know, I know that you've done some colloquia with Liberty Fund, and I'm sure you've attended some as an attendee over the years. And my experience in the last few that I did is that, there are usually 15 or so people at these events, and you have a discussion over the course of several days. And I know we had at least several people who were, let's say, middle of the road to somewhat on the left to sort of spice up the conversation, I suppose. I don't know. I hadn't seen that early on, but I had been seeing that recently. And it's not like I'm just looking to pat us on the back, but our people think to do that. Our people say, well, we're having this colloquium. Why don't we bring some people from the other side in and we'll have a robust conversation? Maybe there is a left-dominated colloquium somewhere that goes out of its way to invite people like us to spice up the conversation, but if it exists, I'm not aware of it.
Yeah, well, I'm sure they exist. Here's a distinction that may be useful. The distinction between people who have an old 1960s liberal viewpoint and people who have a more modern liberal viewpoint.
Ah, okay. I'm interested in this. Let's hear this.
Yeah, the old viewpoint is that you have a great deal of freedom of speech and you hear from everybody and then you make your decision based on it. Everybody gets to speak. And that would be the ideological diversity viewpoint. When I do things, you're right, with Liberty Fund, it's usually a mixed group. The Federal Society tends to be like that. They will always invite people with differing viewpoints. Many of the organizations I work with have exactly that approach. I run something at Georgetown called the Georgetown Institute for the Study of Markets and Ethics, and everything we do, all of our symposia, have people from across the ideological divide. This is the model that says what you want is a marketplace of ideas. So when I put on a symposium, I do have some classical liberals, I have some left liberals, I try to have people from all different disciplines and viewpoints. I like that because I think that if the viewpoint I'm representing is correct, the best way to show that is to put it alongside all of the other arguments and let people see which arguments are best. So that's one model. And people at the Liberty Fund, people that I work with do that, but there are certainly people on the left who do that as well. However, there's there are a lot of people who, when you have academic conferences, they invite all of the leading intellectuals on the subject, and they're not intentionally trying to get a diverse set of viewpoints. And as a result, you have many conferences where everybody is in the same ballpark and there's, you know, little bits of differences about what's being said, but they don't get the same range of opinion. That, you know, to the extent that conservative or libertarian viewpoints are excluded from a great many of these events is problematic to me. If you can't answer the arguments, you're not advancing knowledge by ignoring them. And what's happening is, instead of engaging with interesting arguments, a lot of the academic world is ignoring them. In the article that I wrote, what I had was statistics which show that in fields like social psychology, less than 1% of the faculty hold right-of-center viewpoints. There's been a recent study done that shows only 13% of law professors identify as Republicans. What this means is that when you get these people together, there's viewpoints that just don't get represented, and you don't have a full discussion of ideas as a result.
And of course, on a practical level, if you're holding an event not just for other academics but for the general public, it's going to be much more interesting for the public, and you're going to get a much bigger turnout. I mean, I'm sure you know you get a much bigger turnout for a debate than you do for a lecture. So it actually works to the benefit of your event to have people of different points of view. Let me ask you this as we wrap up. You have experience then in business schools, and I'm slightly getting the impression that in a business school, when you're applying for a position, there might be less of this going on. You might be heard more sympathetically, even though in some business schools, I know the trend toward so-called corporate social responsibility is pretty strong. But in spite of that, do you think a business school is where a libertarian might get to have an easier time of it?
I can only speak for the school that I work at. I'm at McDonough School of Business at Georgetown, and I find this to be, on the whole, a non-ideological place. There's very little of what we're discussing in evidence here, and it may be because business schools and other professional schools our job is to train people to perform their tasks well. Most of my colleagues, the subject of what politics we have very, very rarely comes up. When it comes up in my little corner of the business school because I do business ethics and I do normative work. That's where ideological and philosophical topics and politics comes up more often. Law schools tend to be more ideologically insular because it's a normative field. But for business schools, engineering schools, professional schools, at least in my experience, I think that there's much less of the groupthink problem than there is in traditional humanities or social sciences.
But as a subset of studying business, business ethics, again, my experience is that there aren't that many business ethicists who would take your point of view. I can think of Nick Capaldi at Loyola New Orleans, but I can't think of a whole lot of free market business ethics people. But that could be because I'm very far removed from the field.
No, you're right. Business, since I have now been involved with this for a long time, when I first took a position in a business school, the Business Ethics Academy was almost uniformly radically left-wing. It was simply anti-capitalistic attitude. That was, in fact, they almost defined themselves that way. So that's the way things were. As time has gone by, that's broken down a little bit so that there's a little more diversity now. But it's still a field in which things are skewed greatly to in favor of what would be considered anti-free market approaches. What's nice is that the younger generation coming up is doing more interesting work that is a little bit less polemical and ideologically driven. However, having said that, when you're talking about business ethics, you're talking about one of the fields in which it is skewed toward the left.
On the other hand, that gives you plenty to work on. You'll never run out of anything to do. So in any event, again, I'm going to link to your column at tomwoods.com/642. And I'm glad things have worked out in your case, that you have congenial colleagues and you're in a good and healthy environment. And, you know, may that be the case for everybody, but especially, those of us who are in the intellectual minority, to be able to go out there and just pursue what they want to pursue. Thanks so much for your time today, John. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, remember, the show notes page is not what I said it was in this episode. It's tomwoods.com/643. That's where you'll find a link to the article that we were discussing today. Tomorrow, well, you know what? Actually, I don't know what's – no, I do know what's scheduled tomorrow. Michael Matheson Miller and Poverty, Inc. will be discussed tomorrow. It's going to be great. I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.